I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source with Isabel Wilkerson, epic tale teller of the great migration of Southern blacks that remade America. Sound and spirit, north, south, east, and west in the 20th century. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This is a global story in that the world has seen many mass migrations of very poor farm people, peasants, and serfs toward opportunity. In India and China today, more people migrate from village to city in 1 year than moved with our great migration over 50 years. More than 10 million in Asia every year now, fewer than 10 million in America between 1915 and 1970. That is from World War I to the end of the Civil Rights era, as Isabel Wilkerson has framed her story. But was there ever a migration that, beyond moving people, transformed a national culture as ours did? Songs, games, language, art, style, worship, every kind of entertainment, including pro sports. In fact, almost all we feel about ourselves, how we look to the world, changed in the sweep of this story. Isabel Wilkerson, you're getting so much praise for this book, The Warmth of Other Suns, but I want to add my admiration and thanks. It is a magnificent work, and it's changing me too, Isabel.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
I'm getting ahead of your story, but can we just lay it down here that great swaths of pop and serious culture, the culture I grew up in and my children as well, was fruit of your story. Jazz and its stars like Louis Armstrong, Nat King Cole, Illinois Jacquette, the Basie and the Ellington Bands, stars like Johnny Hodges, whose family moved from Virginia to Boston very early in this century, so many more, Ray Charles, Mahalia Jackson, gospel music, rhythm and blues, the Motown sound, sports immortals like Bill Russell and Jackie Robinson. They're all players in this story. Writers, actors, comedians, Toni Morrison, Spike Lee, Miles Davis, Michelle Obama. They're all children of the Great Migration. Let's listen to Ray Charles singing Georgia, written by Hoagy Carmichael, a white guy, but it's sort of a universal hymn to nostalgia.
Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Georgia on my mind.
I said, Georgia.
In so many ways, he's representing the fact that there was this longing, this kind of exile's desire for being able to connect back home somehow, that they had not really wanted to leave, that they left because they had to leave. And I think that the mournful, doleful nature of that song speaks so much to that desire of and that sense of loss for what they had to let go of in order to pursue the idea of being an American, a full American. When you mention high art, for example, the idea of Toni Morrison, who's a perfect example of this. Toni Morrison's parents were raised in Alabama. They decided they wanted their daughter to go to school and to grow up in the North. They moved to Lorain, Ohio, where she had the opportunity to go to better schools, integrated schools, and to a library. African Americans during a great portion of the 20th century were not able to even walk into a library and take out a book. Where would she be had her parents not had the foresight and the courage to take her out, where she would have the opportunity to read and read and read, take out books, and then to go on to become a Nobel laureate? It's unfathomable. The names
are
stupendous. Where would we be? James
Baldwin. Where would we be without Coltrane?
Just in the literature, James Baldwin, Richard Wright, Ralph Ellison, August Wilson, the playwright, Lorraine Hansberry, another playwright. These people, essentially, their entire art was built around an attempt to understand the Great Migration as they saw it, as the children of this migration. It's really, it's overwhelming when you think of just high art. Then when you get to music.
Why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline, why can't you be true? You done started doing the things you used to do. As I was motivating over the hill.
Connect Chuck Berry to the migration.
Well, Chuck Berry also came up from the South, and he ended up being connected with Chess Records in Chicago and recorded for them. And in some ways, this is an example of the transfer of folk music from the South with the rhythms of the North, the metabolism that's sped up. You can hear that it's a sped up version, very urban, very fast paced. And he became a representative too of how it mutated in some ways, the art form mutated to become a whole new art form. And he was one of the early participants in rock and roll, which also crossed the Atlantic and came back to us in the form of the Rolling Stones or Eric Clapton and many others.
I think it was Clapton who said about rock and roll, they could have just called it Chuck Berry.
Music, as we know it, would simply not be what it is had there not been the Great Migration. For example, Motown simply wouldn't exist. And that's because Berry Gordy, the founder of Motown, his parents were raised in Georgia. They moved to Detroit, where he grew up. When he became a young man, he decided he wanted to go into the music industry. He didn't have the resources to go scouting all over the country. He looked around himself in the neighborhood where he happened to be, and he saw around him, young people, Diana Ross, whose parents migrated from different parts of the South. The Temptations had all come up from Alabama. Aretha Franklin, her parents came up from the South. The Jackson Five, their mother came from Alabama and their father from Arkansas. They met in the North and then had nine children, who all of whom were musical prodigies, essentially, and changed the face of music as we know it. Prince, often not thought of because his father migrated from Louisiana to Minnesota, which was the far end of that migration north along the midsection of the country. It is hard to imagine American music without this migration having occurred. And we haven't even gotten to the issue of jazz, which you mentioned earlier.
Could we listen to just a little bit of Miles Davis's So What from the Kind of Blue album? Is so special, even more so every day somehow. Who is he to you?
Well, he's a legend, and he could not possibly have reached the full realization of his genius had his parents not had the foresight to leave Arkansas, cotton country of Arkansas. However, he also was the beneficiary of the music of the South, because one of the great things about the Great Migration is that it transferred the blues, the spirituals, gospel, the folk music of the South, which had an opportunity to grow in with the metabolism of the North and become a new art form, new art forms in general, rhythm and blues, jazz. And he's a perfect example of one of the best-known people who ever participated in this and benefited.
It's phenomenal. If we talked about sports figures, we'd be here all day and night for weeks. But there are so many important ones. For me, Bill Russell, as a Bostonian, I mean, 13 years in the NBA, 11 national championships. I had not realized, because we thought of him as coming from San Francisco, I had not realized that Bill Russell, too, is a child of the migration from Monroe, Louisiana, where another of your central characters comes from. But dilate a little bit on the great Bill Russell.
Bill Russell would not be who we know him to be had there been no Great Migration, had his parents not had the courage to leave. His parents were having a very rough go of it in Monroe, Louisiana. They lived under a caste system. This Great Migration was essentially a defection. It was a seeking of political asylum, in a way, from a caste system that controlled their every move. From the moment they woke up in the morning to the moment they went to bed, their every movement was determined by this caste system known as Jim Crow. And Bill Russell's family experienced some of the harsh realities of that. And one story involving Bill Russell's father involves a day where Bill Russell's father was just wanting to get gas. And the custom in the Jim Crow South was that when an African-American was in line for something, any white Southerner who came up could cut in line and go before that person. So he had been in line for a while, and it turned out that one white motorist after another showed up, got in front of him, and he had to wait, and he had to wait, and he had to wait. Eventually, he decided he would just back out and make the decision to maybe drive the other half hour to the next gas station and where he might be able to get served. As he was beginning to back out, the owner of the gas station stopped pumping gas for the white motorist he was working with and got a shotgun, held it to Bill Russell's father's head, and said, "You'll leave when I tell you to leave. Don't ever let me see you trying that again." His mother, Bill Russell's mother, was around the same time stopped on the street because she was dressed in her Sunday clothes, which she had worked very hard to save for. And a police officer stopped her and said, "You go home right now and take that off. That is not what a colored woman should be wearing." She had to go home. She was told that if she was seen in that again, she would be arrested. Bill Russell came home. He was about 8 or 9 years old, and he saw his mother crying at the kitchen table. The family decided that they would leave Monroe, Louisiana, a very difficult decision for a faraway place, Oakland, California. And it was there that Bill Russell had the opportunity to go to integrated schools, to be able to go to an NCAA school. He would never have had the opportunity to do that had they stayed in the South. He ended up leading the Dons of the University of San Francisco to 2 NCAA championships, and then, of course, came to the attention of the Celtics, where he helped lead that team to 11 championships out of the 13 years he was there. Basketball, but would not be what we know it to be had this Great Migration not occurred. And he's but one person out of this entire experience of 6 million people who migrated.
There are so many parables here, Isabel Wilkerson, and I just want to get to a few of them. And the extraordinary thing about your book is that each story is different. Each person had to decide on their own, kind of in isolation, that they'd had enough, or this was the moment to go, or that it was worth it. They argued it out, you know, couples and families entirely on their own. It's an amazing story. I want to hear the Wilkerson family migration story. I want to get to the three lives that you followed in the most extraordinary detail. Ida Mae Gladney, George Starling, Ida Mae Gladney being a sharecropper's wife in Mississippi, George Starling being a fruit picker in Orange Blossom, Florida, who ends up coming north and working on the railroad, and then Robert Pershing Foster, coming from relative privilege, goes to Los Angeles as a doctor. He saves Ray Charles's career in a certain way with a surgery when Ray needed it bad. Touched any number of other lives, but where's to begin? I mean, we'll never cover the whole of it, and yet the theme of talent being given a chance and then blossoming in the most spectacular, historic ways runs through this whole book.
Well, I am moved by the idea that this was a leaderless revolution. In other words, there was no one who told these people to make this decision. There was no one who set the day and the time as to when people would go. And these people, in isolation, decided that it was time to go. Ida Mae Gladney, who was, as you said, the wife of a sharecropper, they left because a cousin had been wrongly accused of a theft he had not committed. And when, after her husband had seen what had happened to his cousin, he was beaten to within an inch of his life. And after that, her husband came home and said to her, "This is the last crop we're making." They left Mississippi at night without having told anyone except her mother that they were leaving, and they headed to the Midwest, ultimately landing in Chicago. So that was one.
Introduce George Starling, an obsessively interesting man, tragic in certain ways, but a fighter from conception, it would seem.
It would seem. He had a brief time of being able to go to college, which only made him, I think, more frustrated than anything else. And he was forced to return to picking citrus, which was the primary industry in his part of Florida. Once he got there, because he'd had some education, and he was quite smart, actually, he was valedictorian of his high school class, segregated though it was, he ended up having tremendous frustration over the fact that the work was dangerous and the pay was worse. And he began to lead efforts among these pickers to do work stoppages in order to get a nickel more per box, one nickel more per box for boxes that were ultimately going to go for $3 or $4 in the open market. And it turned out that he had to flee for his life because of threats against his life. He headed to Harlem as a result of those threats. And he ended up working the railroad where he saw the migration unfold before him on the Silver Comet and the Silver Spur and the other trains going back and forth, the migration trains, you might call it. And then finally, we have Dr. Robert Joseph Pershing Foster, who had served his country in the Korean War, had served as a surgeon for the Army. When he got out, however, it turned out he could not practice surgery in his own hometown of Monroe, Louisiana, again the home of Bill Russell. And he set out on a course for California, as had Bill Russell's parents. He found that it was a treacherous journey, one he had not anticipated being so difficult. He ended up having to drive three states without rest because he could not find a place that would give him a room.
You drove that route yourself. He did it in a Buick Roadmaster in 1951, I think it was. El Paso was a great, difficult crossing. For you, what were the most treacherous moments in that ride west in the 1950s, yesterday?
Yes, well, I made the journey, you know, well after that, when we could have stopped anywhere we wanted to. I had my parents in the car with me. They were migrants themselves. They had migrated from the South to Washington, D.C., and they were retired by then and always up for an adventure. And we set out on a course with the caveat that I had to be the one driving. But then we got to the dangerous part of the journey where I knew, based on his, you know, multiple descriptions of the trip to me, that he could not stop. We were taking hairpin curves along the base of the Rocky Mountains. You're on two-lane roads. There were no guardrails in those days. There were for me. But in any case, we ended up making it as far as Yuma, Arizona, and I felt such tremendous empathy for what he had had to go through because we had no trouble at all at the time that we went, which was around 2000, and we had no trouble finding a place at all. He, of course, had not had that luxury in the early 1950s, and he had had to drive all the way through. It's a miracle he made it at all. This was very much the reality for any African American making the crossing in that era. There really simply were no places for them to stop. There was extreme segregation to the degree that there were these green books that people had to turn to in order to give them clues as to where they might stay. They were kind of like a AAA map that would give them suggestions as to where they might stay. They had to essentially plan for the idea that they might not be able to stop. They had to be able to ensure that they had enough water and ice for the radiator if it overheated. They needed to make sure they had enough food to last them for the long trip. They often carried their Bibles with them to read the 121st Psalm, which was a prayer to protect basically pilgrims who were making some long journey. They really were on their own. This was before GPS. It was before cell phones. It's actually quite frightening to think about what they had to undergo in order to just get to these receiving stations of the North and West.
It was, in every sense, a kind of underground railroad in modern times.
I call it the overground railroad.
No wonder there are so many train songs. I think of Duke Ellington's train songs, there are lots of them, including Take the A-Train, but Daybreak Express, for example.
Even if they didn't take the train, it became a symbol of the way of getting out. And it became the determining factor of where people would go because they were following the routes of the trains, following the routes of the buses, and ultimately they determined, those railroads determined, those trains determined where people would ultimately go. These were not haphazard arrivals. These people were following very set routes from to a different place from wherever they happened to be in the South.
Isabel Wilkerson, you write a wonderful line about the migration as the first big step the nation's servant class took without asking. But it was not without brutal pressure in almost all of these stories, as you said, of lynching or direct threats of murder or imprisonment. Could we listen to Billie Holiday singing Strange Fruit, which was, of course, about lynching?
Yes.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
During the decades leading up to the Great Migration and following into the Depression, there was a lynching every 3 days in some part of the South. So the strange fruit that she described would have been a more common sight than one might think. One historian said that to have been black in the South during that era would have meant that all of them, almost all of them, would have either known someone in their town who had been lynched or would have heard of someone nearby who had been lynched. It would have been impossible to avoid hearing about that growing up in the South at that time.
What was the Wilkerson family story in all this?
Yes.
Your own mother and father?
My mother migrated from Rome, Georgia to Washington, D.C. at the end of World War II as a young woman. And she went to Howard University where she met my father, who was a Tuskegee Airman, and he had come up from Southern Virginia. So they would never, ever have met had there been no Great Migration. I grew up around people who were all the children of people from North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Virginia. I was surrounded by the Great Migration, and yet no one called it that. And my parents got me at a school that was on the other side of the park, meaning an integrated school, and she went to a great deal of trouble in order to get me there. She actually made arrangements with a cab company to take me across town to this school where there were many, many children from who were the children of senators and children of ambassadors. So they were, in many respects, immigrant children. And I really found that I had so much in common with the children of the immigrants. And that was because we all had food that our mothers had prepared for our lunchboxes that was so different from the food of the people who'd been there for so much longer. I had this obsession with liverwurst on pumpernickel for a long time because my mother never prepared that for me. In fact, a poet in the South described me as a Southerner once removed because in some ways I felt very much like the child of an immigrant.
You're very, shall we say, generous about connecting this story with all the other immigrations that have formed this country. I mean, what are the common threads, and in what sense is the Great Migration completely a story unto itself?
Well, it's completely a story unto itself because it happened within the borders of this country, and the people who were participants in it were, in fact, American citizens who should not have had to have crossed mountains and gone halfway across the country to experience the privileges that come with being American, the privileges which they were born to. There was no question that they had to leave a caste system that was so arcane that it made it illegal for a black person and a white person to play checkers together in Birmingham, for example, or that there was a black Bible and a white Bible to swear to tell the truth on in many courtrooms throughout the South.
Would you read that passage on page 113, in The Warmth of Other Suns, about the signals of control and the rules of the old white South?
Yes, any African American boarding a bus, and it was slightly different in each city or town as to how elaborate the dance was of just boarding a bus. sometimes they would buy the ticket and then have to get off the bus and go to the back of the bus. Sometimes they could buy the ticket and then go straight through the white section in order to get to the black section. But either way, there was always some signal, some sign that would indicate this part of the bus is for whites, this part of the bus is for blacks. And on this particular bus that the protagonist, Robert Joseph Pershing Foster, was boarding as he was heading north to St. Louis, they kept moving the sign as white people boarded, and only the white people could touch the sign. So if you would like me to read it, it reads, "Those white and colored shingles were as much a part of the southern landscape as cotton growing in the field. Each state and city had a different requirement or custom to signal how the races were to be separated and to what extent the races were to be divided. In North Carolina, white and colored passengers could not occupy, quote, contiguous seats on the same bench, unquote. Virginia prohibited the two races from sitting side by side on the same bench unless all other seats were filled. Several states required that the placard saying white or colored be, quote, in plain letters, not less than 2 inches high. In Houston, the race to which the seat belonged was posted on the back of the seat. In Georgia, the penalty for willfully riding in the wrong seat was a fine of $1,000 or 6 months in prison. Colored passengers were assigned to the front of the rail car on the train, but to the rear of other conveyances to, in the words of the mayor of Birmingham, do away with the, quote, disagreeable odors that would necessarily follow the breezes."
So what does the Great Migration have in common with the Irish, the Italians, the Eastern Europeans, Jews, you name it?
I really believe that one of the great tragedies of the 20th century is that many of the groups that were converging in these big cities of the North, these great dream cities of that attracted so many people from all over the world and from the southern part of the United States, the tragedy was that the people were essentially the same. Many of them were people of the land, people who had worked the land, people who were coming from small towns, often repressive caste systems that they were from which they were seeking freedom in the new world of America as we know it. And yet when they arrived, one group was allowed to join the unions, recruited to join the unions. Others were brought in as strike breakers. Some were allowed to live in many, many different neighborhoods of their choosing. Others were limited to particular, already overcrowded sections that became ghettos. They never imagine all the wonderful and amazing things, relationships and friendships and alliances that could have been made had these people not been torn apart and rendered rivals as opposed to people who might have worked together and made friendships and had greater understanding. Perhaps some of the violence that attended the arrival of the migrants to the North might not have occurred had there been a greater understanding that they were all the same people and had so much more in common. Any immigrant who makes this journey is different from those who stay, by definition. They are more likely to be risk takers. They are less patient with the status quo. They're less likely to be able to accept the repression of the place that they're leaving. They're more likely to be able to say, I can make the break from all that I've known for a place that I've never seen, even without the guarantees in hopes that life will be better. That is the classic American story.
And in my case, it was illiterate Irish peasants from the West in Galway who arrived around 1895 and signed with an X. I mean, it's astonishing.
It is astonishing. It is the classic American story. And if people recognize it, when they see that, you know, when the migration began, 90% of all African Americans were living in the South. By the end of the Great Migration, half were living outside of the South, this great arc from Boston over to Chicago and then over to the West Coast down to Los Angeles. And that means that the majority of African Americans that you meet, just as when you think of a majority of Americans that you might meet, all were descended from people who came from someplace far away, far from where they happen to be. And often these forebears met someone that they would have otherwise never met, created a whole new lineage in Chicago, in Boston, in New York, in Los Angeles, and started whole new family lines, which is how you get a Michelle Obama.
Isabel Wilkerson, we're talking about the setting out and what that took, but then there was the getting there. You refer to the North, both East and West. In the book, it's referred to as the kinder mistress. But these were difficult receptions in Chicago, in New York, even in Los Angeles. tell some of that story about the fear, again, the threat of violence, but also the amazingly foresighted Chicago Commission on Race Relations right around World War I.
Yes. Again, as I was saying about the great tragedy, is there was great fear, misunderstanding, suspicion, and wariness about the arrival of African Americans in such large numbers. In the case of a family called the Clarks, as they attempted to move into this apartment building in Cicero, Illinois, just on the western border of Chicago, they were so excited to have found this apartment because they had been living in a two-room apartment with another family. So basically, had like 10 people living in a two-room flat on the south side of Chicago for a huge amount of money. They found a cheaper apartment, 5 rooms, and they were so excited to move in. When they tried to move in, they were not permitted to by the sheriff. They had to get a court order in order to move in. Eventually, when they were able to move in, they could move their belongings in, but they themselves could move in. The night that their belongings were moved in, a mob of several thousand gathered around them. And of course, these were sadly immigrants who had just arrived not long before themselves, and they gathered around and they stormed the apartment, the second floor apartment, threw out the sofa, the chairs, the piano, all of their belongings, the children's pictures, the wedding pictures, all of that they threw out the second floor window. Then they went and tore out the radiators, the sinks, the fixtures, the faucets, and threw all of them out the window as well. Then they set the pile of belongings on fire. Then they set the building on fire, which then left the white residents who were living in the building homeless.
Mm.
That was the early 50s.
Even in New York, this is 1963, your man George Starling, up from Citrus, Florida, is wondering what in the world he's done. Can I read this paragraph?
Yes.
George Swanson Starling, 1963, New York. Something welled up in George. Everything raced before him. The cheating foreman in the groves, his running for his life, the hangings and burnings, the little southern dog that would rather die than be black, the bomb going off on Christmas Day under the bed of a good man trying to bring justice to Florida. And then there was New York, wide open and stifling at the same time. Yes, he was alive, but it was a slow death in a hard city. He was a baggage handler, for all intents and purposes, and would be no more than that, no matter how much potential he had.
Yes, it was a difficult adjustment to what he had hoped would be a fuller life, and it turned out that the North was not what he expected it to be. Yes, he was freer to do certain things, but there would arise a moment where Jim Crow seemed to be following him. And one of those cases was where he had gotten back from a long run on the train. And he always used to look forward to coming to the North because it was always less stress just being in the North. I mean, he didn't have to worry about, getting on the bad side of a sheriff just because he didn't say sir. I mean, it was just a freer world in so many ways. And so he always felt relaxed when he got back to New York. However, this time he went to get a drink at a bar near Penn Station, which is where he operated out of as a railroad porter. And they stopped at the bar, got their glass of beer. After they'd finished them, they set the glasses down. The bartender quietly and without comment took the glasses and smashed them against the counter where all the other patrons looked and could see that what the bartender had done was that he had broken the glasses because if they had touched the lips of a person who was black, they were no longer fit to be used for by anyone else. And that stayed with him and reminded him that there could still be moments when he could be reminded of the caste that he had been born into, even in New York.
Isabel Wilkerson, can I ask you, just as a matter of method, who elicited all these stories? Did you do all the interviews on all your principal subjects or what? I mean, the stories themselves, the storytellers are so brilliantly chosen and then given so much encouragement here.
I conducted interviews with over 1,200 people. In the course of doing the interviews with these people, I had a researcher who was helping me track down the best places to go to find them. I went to AARP meetings. I went to senior centers. I went to Baptist churches, Catholic mass. I went to churches in New York where everyone was from South Carolina. I mean, I went to high school reunions and all kinds of places where it could be thought that people who had migrated would be, senior citizens would be. And so I had help with some of the the initial interviewing, but the relationships with and the interviews with the three main characters were by me. I went to the South with two of the three people. Robert Foster had no desire to go back, so he did not. But Ida Mae Gladney and George Swanson Starling did agree to go back. And, you know, I had a wonderful experience with Ida Mae Gladney in particular, who, when we got to cotton fields, she actually wanted to stop and pick some. I mean, she hadn't wanted to pick when she was a sharecropper, but now that she didn't have to and we got there and she hadn't been to Mississippi in decades and she saw it and something made her feel like she wanted to get out. So I said, are you sure we can pick in this field? I mean, this land belongs to somebody. And besides that, we're in Mississippi. And she said, oh, they won't care what little bit we're about to pick. And so we got out there. We spent maybe 10 minutes, you know, just I had never even seen cotton growing before. But it was, you know, she went out there and I got out there and I took pictures and some of them would be on the website. And she just enjoyed it. And then we got back in the car and we went on about our way to visit some of the people that she knew or those that we could find. So
and she was how old by then?
She was in her 80s. She was in her late 80s by then. But she had the energy to get out there, jump out of the car and go out into that field.
Let's talk about the hard part as these lives approach their ends, and you see them all to their graves in this book. Their lives in some were difficult, and their next generation was even more troubled in certain ways. Start with Ida Mae, who lived peacefully in Chicago, surrounded by family and her church and her work, but surrounded also by crime like crazy on the South Side, dope, helplessness. This is a very grim place to have escaped to.
Yes, it is. I mean, what had happened was she and her family, like many immigrants actually, decided that they would move as multiple generations into a three flat, meaning an apartment building with three actual apartments in it, and it would be three generations that would be living in this one apartment building. And they thought it was wonderful. It was a lovely Italian family that sold the house to them. But within months, the neighborhood had turned from all white to completely black. And in doing so, so did the bakery. The bakery left, the ice cream parlor left, all of those things that make for a neighborhood left as the proprietors left as well. And then they were replaced with liquor stores and payday loan places. That it happened so quickly that the neighborhood was really never able to recover. No one wanted to invest in the neighborhood anymore. And then she found herself surrounded by people who were no longer owners because the turnover had happened so quickly. And she was surrounded by people who ultimately might have been dealing drugs or in gangs, and she found that was what had occurred to the neighborhood that she had so loved when she first arrived. Mm. Oddly enough, though, she was such a warm and loving person that even they liked her, and they looked out for her, and they would warn her to stay inside because we're going to be shooting this afternoon.
Oh, Lord. But she looks out her window at tremendous degradation. It's a very sad scene. Talk about George Starling, who had an unhappy marriage, children in and out of wedlock, but a tragic adventure with drugs in the next generation.
Yes. He is an example of how the children, because he and his wife were working so hard. It's my contention that one of the things that happened to this next generation was several things. One is their parents were extraordinarily hard workers, and because they were hard workers, they were not always able to be there when the children got out of school. Secondly, they had come from small towns where they were surrounded by neighbors and friends and family. And even though life was very difficult because of Jim Crow, they still had, there were lots of eyes and ears watching out for their children. Here, that wasn't the case. And they were not accustomed to the dangers of the North. They could not even anticipate or have the idea of what might be happening out there in the streets. They couldn't fathom what was happening. They did not anticipate how bad it could be in these crowded, overcrowded, dangerous streets that were drawing in their children. And he was one who essentially lost his son and, in a way, his daughter to the streets of New York.
And then finally, among your big three, there's Dr. Foster. Ray Charles is Dr. Foster in that song, Hide No Hair. He has a very successful private practice for a while. He ends up kind of willy-nilly in a VA medical center under a lot of bureaucratic pressure and maybe racial disdain too. His heart is weakening before he dies. He's in trouble at the end. But the thing I'd like you to dwell on, Isabel, is that all of these three migrants come to a point in their lives when they are asking themselves, would they have been better off in the South?
They do ask themselves that. We would talk about that quite a bit. And it turned out that they would all have said, and they all did say, they would say that we've made many mistakes in our lives, but leaving the South was not one of them.
And do you agree?
I would absolutely agree, because in some ways, however you want to define success, for them, remembering what they were leaving, remembering the world of Bill Russell's parents, remembering the world that they were living in, even though life was not perfect, they had such modest goals. They were not looking to run Fortune 500 companies and to own skyscrapers. They were looking to be able to get in line, get gas in the order in which they had arrived. They were looking to be able to have their children be able to go to a school where they could actually take a book out of the library. They had very modest goals. So when you think about the modest goals of these people who were like, any immigrant group who might have come here just wanting to be able to to survive in the new world in hopes that life might be better. In some ways, leaving was its own point. Getting out was its own point. This migration helped to lead, we've talked about literature, high literature, we've talked about music, we've talked about sports. But politically, this migration was huge because many of the states of the North and the West, which we consider to be blue states, are blue states in part because of this transfer of people who had never voted before but now were in the North and the West and were able to vote. And they ended up voting as Democrats, loyal blue people, you might say, often. That was one thing. Secondly, this great migration in some ways paved the way for the civil rights movement or the human rights movement, as I like to call it, which then led the way to other freedom movements for women and for other groups. And that was because the people who left showed that the members of this lower caste system that had been defined by Jim Crow in the South had options that it did not have before, and they were willing to act upon them. Secondly, these people provided leverage for those who stayed and were the ones who were bearing up under the sheriff's dogs and those hoses. And they provided a kind of leverage because these people who had to fight that final battle for civil rights, they knew that there was a place that they could go if things got too difficult for them. They knew that there was also another way. They had not been exposed to the options of the North. The options of the North didn't exist for them before the Great Migration occurred. And so the migration provided leverage for those who stayed and fought the final battle. And then finally, the people who left also provided financing for the civil rights movement and for the people in the South who were, who were depending on it. How typical is it of the immigrant to want to take care of those back home because they're making more money up in the North and they would send money back. And that helped to also fuel the effort toward civil rights and the legislation that that changed finally the South and made it a place where now the children and grandchildren of the Great Migration can participate in what's called a reverse migration because the reasons for the original Great Migration had been resolved to a large degree, not completely, but to a great degree.
Let's go out on the Count Basie Band, if we may. So many children of the Great Migration in the band playing Midnight Blue. Can I give you my own reader's definition of the victory here?
Yes, I'd love to hear it.
Well, I just keep thinking all of these stories vindicate the genius of the individual, of human gifts when given opportunity and the fruits that are sort of waiting there to be recognized. And it also speaks incredibly well overall, it seems to me, over the span of a century and hundreds, thousands, millions of lives about the process of adaptation in this country. One of the things I kept thinking was if China and India, in their own processes of fantastically huge migration now, if they come out of the process with individuals that will have changed their cultures as expressively and as profoundly, even for the whole world to notice and enjoy, as the Black Americans of the 20th century did, they'll be very lucky. I mean, it is a marvelous record overall, it seems to me, of a country and a culture dealing with the challenge to recognize unrecognized people, to touch the untouchables and then to deal with them and to hear from them in glory.
You're absolutely right. I think that the world will be lucky if we can see a similar outgrowth and outpouring of artistic expression and other kinds of expression. Because ultimately, this was a leaderless revolution in which the individuals defied their own leaders who had told them, stay in the South. This is the land of the forefathers. This is the land that our forefathers worked for free, and we must stay here and maintain our role here because this is where we belong. The people didn't listen to it. The people went out and did exactly what their hearts told them to do, and that meant that as you described it, the genius of the individual, the power of the individual. To me, it's an inspiration to everyone who is the descendant of someone who participated in this or any other migration experience. And that is that if they could do that, then what is it that we can do? There's nothing that we can't do if you think of it that way. What a legacy they've left for all of us. What a legacy they've left of courage and great heart. Great heart. I get filled with inspiration just thinking about it. And I have such a more enormous gratitude for my parents for what they did and for all of these people and for anyone who would participate in, who would leave a place so far away for some place that they'd never seen. I'm just filled with gratitude.
Isabel Wilkerson, I'm grateful to you for telling such an extraordinary story so beautifully. I hadn't quite realized that you did all the interviewing yourself. It's a phenomenal accomplishment and a deeply moving one at any level, in any part of the world, to think of migrants in this frame. Isabel Wilkerson, thank you. Thank you for the warmth of Other Suns. Thank you for the warmth of this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Ben Mandelkern and Katie Okamoto produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till you feedback on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.